Welcome to Legal Nurse Podcast, where you will get tips to expand your legal nurse consulting skills. Every week, you'll hear from experts from within and outside of legal nurse consulting. They will share their knowledge to help you grow. Your show is moderated by Pat Iyer, a legal nurse consultant with 30 years experience. So, join our community, sit back, relax, and get ready to learn. Here's Pat.
Hi, I'm Pat Iyer with Legal Nurse Podcast. I have the pleasure of bringing to you Alfreda Whitley. Legal Nurse Podcast is in its sixth show, and we have listeners in 85 countries. No matter where you are in the world, you'll enjoy hearing from Alfreda as we talk about a role that nurses play in the risk management and quality assurance world. You know those terms? You probably have not been in those roles. Alfreda knows them. Alfreda grew up in Texas, was educated in Texas, lives in Texas, loves Texas, and started off in the Michael DeBakey Cardiovascular Intensive Care Unit. If you know Michael DeBakey's name from doing the first heart transplant, wasn't it, Alfreda, that he did back in the day? It was the pioneer who took that bold step. Let's focus, first of all, on defining these terms of quality assurance. Let's start right there. What is that all about?
What is quality assurance? Well, quality assurance are going to make sure that you are following your process consistently. They're your auditors, your analysts of your organization.
And I have personal experience being a nursing quality assurance coordinator in the last job that I held, which was in 1987, the last time I got a paycheck from anybody. And I remember the analytical aspect of that role, and it was a great preparation for going into legal nurse consulting.
Absolutely.
Often in acute care facilities now, the role of the quality assurance person and the risk manager may be combined, but they can be separate.
Yes.
How do we differentiate between those two?
Well, your risk manager is really focused on mitigating risk. So if you're starting a new process, you want to definitely involve risk management because they're going to be able to help identify those breakdowns in your process.
And I can remember from being a member of the American Society of Healthcare Risk Management that risk management could encompass a whole lot more than what went on in the clinical units. What other aspects of that role come into play?
The other items that fall are the non-clinical areas. So for example, you have a slip and fall at your facility that involves risk management. That's a non-clinical involvement with risk management.
And I recall they also were involved in establishing contracts, reviewing contracts, looking at those pieces, may be involved in talking with the credentialing department about the screening process that goes into place when particularly a new physician applies for privileges.
Yes.
Is that a person that we need to watch carefully or we have any reservations about or has a clean record?
Or is there a liability issue there? Absolutely.
Yes. As legal nurse consultants, we often get requests from attorneys to find out or to analyze information that comes in the form of a medical record. But the other big piece is an incident occurs. There's an incident report. There is a potentially a root cause analysis if this is a significant injury. Can you tell us a little bit about the root cause analysis piece first? Because that's a mystery for many people who've never been involved in that proceedings don't know if we can get hold of the reports that are generated, who's involved in that. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, root cause analysis is a process in which we use to identify where we had a breakdown and how we can improve our process. So for example, there are multiple ways actually that you can break down for root cause analysis. Two of the more popular are SBAR, the situation background, and assessment and response. And the other is the five whys. So for example, we had late delivery on our pain medication, or we had late delivery on a product. Why? Well, there was documentation in two different places. Why? Well, it's convenient for me to document over here. Why? Well, I missed orientation on the new process. Why? I had a conflict with another training. We've gone through five levels of why to identify that we need to offer additional training for the PM staff because they had a conflict with another training course. Mm-hmm. So that's an example of going through the five why process and identifying where we had a breakdown.
And I know that for many of us, we may be familiar with the name Deming and the mm-hmm. American who went to Japan after World War II to understand how the Japanese were producing such high quality products. It used to be that made in Japan was equivalent to junk. And then the Americans helped them train and then brought those Japanese techniques back to the United States. This is one of those little miscellaneous facts that's stored in this part of my brain, you know, from 25 years ago. A lot of the techniques that we use in root cause analysis come from the Japanese culture.
Yes.
Can you share with us, you know, some of the things that you have seen that are effective in doing a root cause analysis?
Well, in breaking down and doing a root cause analysis, it really helps hone in and brings together the quality and the risk and how to fine tune our processes and make improvements. For example, we have initiatives brought by the IHI on how to decrease maternal mortality. So we have a maternal death. Well, what are we going to do about that? What happened? Where do we have a breakdown? And how can we turn those numbers around?
Am I correct in assuming that you've participated in these?
Yes, I have.
Can you give us a sense of the dynamics in the room? Because what hits me is that we're very afraid in healthcare of having fingers pointed at us, of being afraid of being accused of making mistakes. Now, on the other side of this, as legal nurse consultants, we get rewarded for pointing fingers at people and analyzing liability. But when we're wearing the white shoes and the colored scrubs, we don't want those fingers pointing at us. Do you encounter, or have you encountered, people who become very defensive in those conversations?
Yes, I have. And root cause analysis and quality is not, risk management is not to be a punitive approach. We are trying to improve quality and better outcomes for our clients, our patients. And in order for us to reach those more favorable outcomes, we have to have some uncomfortable conversations to reach those results. So it is a collaborative effort with the providers, the nurses, the respiratory therapists, the environmental services, with every person in the organization for us to come together and identify where we are having a breakdown, because we are all there because we want the better outcomes. We want our clients. We want our patients.
What happens if you get involved in that conversation? You brought up environmental services, so I was just thinking of an example of, say, a patient slipped in the hallway because the floor was wet. But initially, when you started the root cause analysis conversation, you didn't realize that it was an environmental services housekeeping issue. Do you stop the meeting, bring those people in? Do you reconvene if you identify additional players who need to be involved in this discussion?
Oh, absolutely. We would definitely stop and reconvene because everyone needs to be at the table. We need representation from every department at the table. And all those departments are invited, but we do have to have that representation.
Are they all invited to every meeting, or only the ones where you think it might be applicable?
They're invited to all those meetings.
Okay. Interesting. I have not participated in them. I've only read about them. So this is a great insight to help people who have not sat on those hot seats. What type of minutes or notes or reports typically come out of a root cause analysis?
That is an internal process. So that is protected information. So I know you mentioned before incident reports, peer reviews, all of those are internal and protected. Those things are not shared with legal. They are important documents, but they are not. Mm-hmm. They're not. It's privileged information.
Well, and in some states, the incident report is obtainable after filing suit, but not before. And in some states, they take the position that the incident report is peer review or protected information. So it varies from state to state in the United States. Incident reports have also gone through quite a transition from being very detailed with identifying information to something that's more generic, more computerized, to be able to look for trends and patterns. But
I want to clarify,
right.
Peer review is not privileged information. That is confidential.
Yes, yes. In fact, that question just came up this week, actually, Alfreda. I was observing a deposition of a doctor. Mm-hmm. The deposition was being done by Zoom, and the attorney instructed her attorney, she was the defendant, her attorney instructed her to not mention anything that was brought up in the morbidity and mortality committee meeting that was held mm-hmm. after the incident. And she indicated she understood. And then the plaintiff attorney asked her a question, and she blurted out what was discussed in the morbidity and mortality committee meeting. Mm-hmm. And the defense attorney, whose hand I could see because I was watching her, she was on camera. I could see the hand go, "We discussed that you shouldn't be saying that." And then he got himself into control. So yeah, the horses, as we say in the States, the horses run out of the barn through the corral, and we close the corral, but the horse is already down the pasture. It's too late.
That's right. It's already out.
Yes. We've talked about the risk of becoming defensive. What other dynamics or what other pressures have you observed that are on people who are in this kind of a discussion?
Oh, there's a lot of passion there. You know, because we are dealing with lives. So there's a lot of passion there from everyone involved in the room. Again, no one wants to be blamed, and we're all trying to control our emotions to come to a better outcome or to determine what happened without being defensive. So it's hard sometimes, challenging in healthcare, to remove those emotions because you're in healthcare because you do care. You have those emotions. And that also helps you to be a good healthcare provider, to have that emotional piece. But when we are striving to figure out where we have a breakdown in quality, we have to keep that piece. We have to keep that piece in check, and we have to allow ourselves mentally to be strong so we can determine where we had our breakdown.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever been completely taken off guard and surprised by something that you heard in a root cause analysis?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Can you give us an example of what might be coming out of that discussion that would catch you off guard?
The phrase, we did everything right.
Mm. And yet?
We didn't have a good outcome.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
That's a hard one to swallow, Pat. Yeah.
But, you know, I could think of clinically situations where there might have been some catastrophe brewing in the patient's brain or body that no one could have foreseen, where that expression might be valid. What do you think?
I think that's possible. Sometimes, you know, sometimes bad things happen and there was nothing we could do about it. Sometimes there are things that we miss and mm-hmm. we could have done things differently.
Mm-hmm.
So if we have a patient that comes in and they're high risk for hemorrhaging and we schedule them on a Friday, well, it might be better to schedule them on a Monday or a Tuesday because there's more staff there. There's more rooms available. And we're just setting ourselves up for a more favorable outcome. Even worst case scenario, if we're not scheduling on a Friday, but a Saturday, realistically, there are more people on call. They're not actually in house. So in order to put yourself in a more favorable situation for a bad outcome, we will schedule that on a day where we had all players in place, all things were aligned. So we were better suited for those catastrophes.
Before we continue with the show, I'd like to share this special announcement with you. My name is Pat Iyer, and my life was changed forever when I walked into a conference room when I was in graduate school and I saw a woman sitting in a wheelchair. She was slumped over, looked dejected, and explained to us that she was paralyzed. Her husband had hit her with a baseball bat and broken her back. And I sat there thinking, why did she stay with him? Why didn't she just leave? Because in my life, being raised by a strong mother, I couldn't imagine my mother sitting still and being abused and not leaving that situation. I decided to write my paper on the topic, and that paper I turned into a nursing journal article, and that nursing journal article led me to write more articles and then my first book, and I started testifying as an expert witness in nursing malpractice cases and built a very large and successful legal nurse consulting business. Now, the irony in all of this was that about a year after my nursing journal magazine article was published, my mother called me up one day and she said, I'm leaving Ken. And I said, why? And she said, well, he hit me. And I went to the emergency room and I had them take pictures of me. And then I went home and I said, here are the terms. And here's how we're going to play this game. And this is what's going to happen. And she reacted just as I expected. But I thought, I didn't even realize that she was living in that volatile situation. That got me interested even more on domestic violence. And I teamed up with Teresa DeVitt Lynch, who is a forensic nurse with deep knowledge of domestic violence and interpreting and analyzing those kinds of cases. So, Therese, let's talk a little bit about the conference that we have planned that's coming up and some of the topics that we're going to be discussing in that two-day online virtual conference that we've scheduled for June 9 and 10, 2022.
Yeah, I'm very excited about this. Day one, we're going to talk about closed head injuries, forensic psych issues related to domestic violence, and how forensic psychologists are involved in these cases in the criminal system, strangulation. And then, you know, for closed head injuries and strangulation, there'll be a couple of LNCs discussing what to look for in the medical records. A lot of the times these cases are very difficult for prosecutors to try because of the dynamics of the relationship. It's a very manipulative relationship, and often the victim will either recant their statements or refuse to testify because of either manipulation or threats made by the perpetrator. And so, you know, having the medical evidence available and having somebody versed in the dynamics of domestic violence, the injuries associated with the different types of mechanisms of injuries, can be a key element to getting people held responsible for their actions, because that could be used in lieu of the testimony of the victim in some cases.
Our focus in this two-day conference is to prepare you as a legal nurse consultant so that you can effectively help attorneys with handling these kinds of cases. They may come up as part of working on another case. There might be, for example, you're working on a personal injury case, and then you realize that some of the injuries of the victim are not due to the car crash, but might have been pre-existing or may occur afterwards. So it can be woven into other cases that you're involved in. And if you've ever worked in the emergency department as a nurse, you know that it can be very difficult to elicit the details from a woman, particularly if that woman comes to the emergency department accompanied by a man. I don't mean to imply, and I think, Teresa, I sound like, since we're talking about she, there are men who are battered by other people in the household. And there's elder abuse, which is another whole area of exploration. Yep. We would love for you to be able to sign up for this conference. You can go to this link, which is http://lnc.tips/dv. That stands for domestic violence. That link again, right below here, is http://lnc.tips/dv. Take this opportunity to broaden your knowledge about this special kind of case and show another area of skill that you can use when you are assisting your attorney clients. Thanks so much. Now let's return to the show. You remind me of the weak spots in our system, the change or shift report as being a weak spot when nurses are distracted. Yes. In July in the United States, when new interns and residents switch rotations, yes, beginning of July, the weekends, holiday weekends.
Absolutely.
Night shift. Mm-hmm. There are all times when we are challenged to maintain that same quality of care.
Yes.
Oof. We've talked about the pressures of being involved in a root cause analysis, that tendency to get defensive, the tendency to get emotional because of the passion. We all, as healthcare providers, wake up when we're taking care of patients. We don't wake up in the morning and say, whose life can I ruin today?
Absolutely.
We all want to do good, and yet bad things happen. And the medical malpractice world that you and I are involved in as legal nurse consultants consistently show us that bad things happen all the time. As a person with a risk management background and in that role, how does that person serve as a patient advocate?
That's a sweet spot, Pat. That's what keeps us going. So one of the pleasures or stories I'll share, I had an opportunity to was really collaborate in that role when I was in quality in the acute setting, was to collaborate with the sepsis coordinator a lot. I worked very closely with the coordinator. And my role was to focus on turning around our mortality. And as you know, sepsis increases risk of mortality. So of course, I'm going to work hand in hand with the sepsis coordinator. So every morning I would wake up and every morning I would go to the job and look at the board and just determine who was high risk. And I would look at, you know, how many weeks this mom was for delivery. And if the mom was less than 22 weeks, she's considered high risk. That's a high risk preterm, which means the baby's not going to have the best survival rate. So that's who my target was. And so I looked on the board and I had a mom delivering, going to preterm labor at 22 weeks. And I grab my coordinator, we're looking at the labs, and I was like, this mom looks like she needs help. And so we looked, we saw that there was a potential there of flagging sepsis, and just went to go check in with the provider and see, hey, are we going to implement this sepsis bundle? This lady is flagging. And the bundle was implemented, and that mom was there a couple more weeks before she delivered. So she delivered at 23 weeks. And that is it's still a very premature baby, but definitely at an age in which resuscitative measures are possible. And I remember a couple of weeks later being on the elevator, and I looked up, and it's a mom there on the elevator with a name tag on. And behind the scenes in quality, they never know who you are. But I knew her name, and she was there delivering milk for her baby. Mm-hmm. And I looked up and I told her, congratulations on her baby. And that was the sweetest thing for me. Mm-hmm. Pat, that just gave me so much joy to know that I made a difference, and I saw her. She was there, and she didn't know, but she had a favorable outcome, and she had a baby that she had a chance to see and hold.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That is wonderful, and shows the value of following the standards, implementing the sepsis bundle, being alert to the changes that warrant implementing those actions.
Absolutely.
It brings me back to when I went into premature labor with my first child at 29 weeks and was put on a medication to suppress contractions and was on bed rest for 4 weeks just to squeeze out more time with that baby inside of me rather than in the neonatal intensive care unit. So he was ultimately born at 36 weeks. And my experience of having a premature baby led me to write an article for a nursing journal called My Baby Was Premature, a very original title. I described what it was like to be a mother and a nurse and watch these events from those two different lenses. You know, we can't separate the nursing part of us when we're patients. And yes. I wrote some recommendations and some impressions of that experience. My child is now 45 years old and is perfectly fine and healthy. How yes, fortunate awesome. For that woman that you were in that spot and could give her that additional gift of time.
Yes.
Yes. For that prenatal patient, bringing us into the medicine a little bit further, why is sepsis such a risk for that patient?
Sepsis is a risk not only for the mom, it's a great risk for that baby. So it's very high risk with sepsis and a maternal patient because we have two lives. And sepsis increases your risk of preterm labor, and it also increases the risk of mortality because you're going into preterm labor and that baby and the mom, or their bodies are fighting infection.
And then what does the sepsis bundle accomplish in that situation?
The sepsis bundle accomplishes that there's the blood cultures are in there, urine cultures, there's a bolus of fluids, antibiotics. So we immediately are being proactive in trying to turn those things around that to identify the source of infection, treat that, and put the patient, the mom, the baby in a better outcome and suppress that labor.
Can you identify how your experience working in the quality assurance risk management world impacts the way you approach cases as a legal nurse consultant?
Well, it definitely helps for me to understand the interworking of what's going on clinically. And it helps me also identify what's missing. In some cases, there could be pieces of the records missing that are very pertinent to what was done or what was or them adhering to the standard or not. And just knowing what it's like clinically and those inner workings helps me analyze those records a lot more quicker and pull out those key pieces.
And you went from risk management to working in a law firm. Was that the pathway that you followed?
Yes, somewhat. I started off in a law firm and then I jumped into quality and then I went back to a law firm. So there's a lot of investigation going on in both, and they both overlap in the fact that you're upholding the standards. In quality, we're trying to uphold the standards and mitigate risk. And in legal, we're also trying to uphold the standards because sometimes things happen that are not good, but that doesn't mean that we didn't follow the standard. We just have unfavorable outcomes sometimes. So I think in both roles is very supportive to the nursing standards and healthcare.
And then as the last question I would want to ask you about this is, do you have any advice to legal nurse consultants who are listening to this program who might be considering looking for a job in a law firm?
I would tell you to don't shy away from what you're uncomfortable with. There is so many learning opportunities. It can be challenging to try to figure things out on your own. And there is a umbrella of attorneys usually in these firms. They have different type of cases with different type of background, and it's okay. Like me, I have a very strong cardiovascular background, Well, it's okay that I'm working with a malpractice that does mostly ortho cases. That's okay. You can still apply that critical care or whatever your specialty is to any case because you know how to break things down. And it gives you an opportunity to stay sharp and learn something new. I really enjoy learning new things. I'm the lifelong student. And you don't have to be in school to be a student to learn something new.
Mm-hmm. That's well put. Lifelong students. I think that describes us as legal nurse consultants perfectly.
Yes, absolutely.
If our listener who's watching this, if our viewer who's watching this on our YouTube channel, Legal Nurse Business, or listening to it on our audio channels, wanted to contact you, what would be the best way for them to do so?
Oh, you can access my website, and that is www.awlegalnurse.com.
www.aw.legalnurse.com?
awlegalnurse.com.
Okay. Okay. I threw an extra dot there that didn't belong. awlegalnurse.com. And we'll put that link right below this video if you're watching this program on our YouTube channel. Thank you so much, Alfreda, for sharing your knowledge and taking us into those hospital corridors behind that closed door of the root cause analysis meeting and giving us a little bit more insight about what takes place in those crucial conversations.
Absolutely. Thanks, Pat. It's my pleasure.
Thank you. And thank you to you who's been spending the last 30 minutes or so with us as we go through this discussion. Be sure to tell another legal nurse consultant about Legal Nurse Podcast. And if you've got a topic or a question that you want to share with me, you can reach me at pateyer@legalnursebusiness.com. Thanks so much. This is Pat Iyer with Legal Nurse Podcast. I have been talking with Marianne Seibold, who spent 4 years in a role of reviewing care delivered to Medicare Advantage patients before she opened up her legal nurse consulting business. And if you've never been part of this world, I think you'll find it fascinating to understand why this is such a big issue in healthcare in the United States, and what type of system exists to try to reduce the problems that are created in our system. Marianne, what were some of the key points that we talked about in your show?
Well, we did talk about utilization management and how that's a process to ensure that the appropriate care is going to the appropriate patient at the appropriate level. And we just talked about how it's important to have a nurse review those cases because they, with their healthcare knowledge and evidence-based criteria practices, can be saving healthcare dollars and preventing waste, inappropriate use, abuse, and fraud within the healthcare system to ensure that healthcare costs don't balloon out of control. We use evidence-based practice both within the facilities and within the insurance companies and compare that to ensure that the standards of care are being met. If those standards of care conflict, there are appeals processes and higher levels of review that can be conducted. There are several agencies that do regulate UMs within the insurance programs and within the healthcare facilities that they do sometimes conflict, but majority of the time, especially in the insurance industry, you might focus on the more stringent of the two to ensure that you're meeting compliance across the board.
As you can see, we covered a lot of territory, and I think you'll get a lot out of Marianne's podcast. Be sure to click on down, click over to her full interview so that you get the benefit of her knowledge and perhaps a new perspective on what goes on behind the scenes in reviewing the quality of care in healthcare. Thanks so much.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Check out Pat Iyer's resources for legal nurse consultants on LegalNurseBusiness.com. Pat coaches legal nurse consultants so they make more money, get more clients, and avoid expensive mistakes. Check out her coaching program at LNCAcademy.com. Please subscribe to our podcast and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Join our community to get notified of each new episode and to receive the transcript of today's program. Complete the request form on podcast.legalnursebusiness.com. We appreciate you and your interest.